Dear students, we are about ready to finish up bonds, and in this final presentation, we'll take a look at yield spreads and the yield curve and its potential to be a harbinger of horrible things in our economy. And then we'll take a look at bond valuation, which turns out to be a whole lot easier and a whole lot more predictable than stock valuation. And we'll end with some odds and ends about bonds, some bond strategies, and some risks other than the inflation risk and the default risk that we've already discussed. So let's get started on slide number 20, yield spreads. Well, you're already familiar with this term in investing, right? The spread, that's the difference between two entities in investing. When we were discussing the spreads in stocks, we were talking about the difference between the ask price, the retail price, what we pay as retail investors, and the bid price, what we receive when we sell our shares, the wholesale price. Well, the same thing is true here, except these are spreads in interest rates. So let's read together slide number 20. Yield spreads are the differences in interest rates that exist among various sectors of the bond market. Now, in general, the shorter the maturity, the lower the rate. The longer the maturity, the higher the rate, which makes sense, and we'll discuss that in detail. I mean, just think about it. If you're going to lend your money for 3 or 6 months, there's a whole lot fewer things that can happen if you lend your money for 20 years or 30 years. And then the higher the rating of the bond, the lower the interest rate, and vice versa. So just as those of us who have really good credit scores typically pay less interest, we have a lower interest rate, and people with not the best credit scores pay a higher interest, the same thing is true for bond issuers, corporations, municipalities, the federal government. The higher the credit score, the less the interest rate is going to be. And in general, treasuries carry the lowest rates because the United States government's not going to go bankrupt. I don't care what anybody says. We sure? But no, it's not going bankrupt. And then munis are next, because it's very rare, but sometimes a municipality goes bankrupt. It's happened quite a few times, actually, in the Great Recession, but not as many times as people predicted it would. General obligation bonds normally are considered less risky than revenue bonds, but it depends on the entity. It depends on what type of entity is creating that revenue. Bridge authorities, water authorities, sometimes they are extremely reliable. And then, of course, corporate bonds have the highest rates. They're fully taxable, and corporations go bankrupt a whole lot more often than municipalities. Non-callable are going to have lower rates than callable, because non-callable are more preferable to investors, knowing that they can't call the bond away from us. Right? Makes sense. So now, on slide 21, we see a table that, if you're looking at this on your cell phone, you're probably going to go, I can't see that. But there's the link, so check out the days, today, your days. This is April 8th, 2019. Spreads. Check out the different interest rates of, they actually add CDs to the mix here. Treasuries and corporate bonds and municipal bonds. And this is courtesy of Fidelity. Fidelity Investments, thank you very much. So we're plugging Fidelity Investments. And they're a very smart marketing group, folks. If you get an account with them, they give you quotes on tens of thousands of bonds. Very sharp. And they have just announced, I just read their little advertisement, that they have reduced the markup and markdown that they charge. So hey, the check. If you're a bond investor, you might not be interested in having your own personal broker, because you're not dealing in the tens of thousands of dollars, and you could go with Fidelity and buy your individual bonds through them. So there's the advertisement. But what we see is that indeed corporates pay higher interest rates than munis and treasuries. And in this case, we're seeing a very unusual situation that has a lot of people very worried about the near-term future, which we'll discuss in just a few slides. But before that, let us discuss the idea of a tight spread and a wide spread. Often investors will speak about the bond spreads as being tight or wide. A tight spread means the interest rates among the bonds that they are evaluating are very close to one another. For example, you're looking at a treasury that's paying 4.8% and a corporate bond that's paying 5.1%. And you say, wow, I'm not getting much more interest for taking on the added risk of buying a corporate bond, am I? Now, what's the spread? Well, in this case, it's what? 0.3, right? 0.3%? Well, what will the people on the talking heads on television say? Oh, it's 30 basis points. Because a basis point is 0.01%. Why can't they just talk like regular people? I don't know. But anyway, 30 basis points. Whereas the next example is a wide spread where we are looking at a treasury paying 3.2% and a corporate bond paying 8.2%. That's 500 basis points or 5%. For several years, bond yield spreads were very tight throughout the 2000s. During the turmoil of 2008-09, the yield spreads widened to levels not seen in decades. You got to go back to the Great Recession. Why? Well, it's called a flight to quality. And investors sold their stocks, sold their bonds, their corporate and muni bonds, and rushed to the safety, the inherent safety that people love about treasury bonds. And what did that do? Well, that raised the price, which lowered the interest rate. Meanwhile, as we saw in Chapter 9, people dumped corporate bonds. They dumped municipal bonds, which sent the yields skyrocketing. So the spreads were huge. Well, the world did not end. I guess it ended for some people, right? It ends for some people every day. But throughout the past decade, yield spreads have narrowed significantly to the point where we had a situation where treasuries were paying just a little bit less than some corporate bonds. But that's changing. That's changing. As many people are worried about the possibility of a coming recession. Now, folks, we know a recession is going to come. It's going to happen. We just don't know when, right? But stick with us because we might be seeing one sooner than we all thought. Slide number 23 shows us the general relationship of interest rates versus inflation. So the blue are the interest rates, starting back in 1960, around 4%. And then as inflation took hold, there's the red inflation. Notice it's much more volatile. As inflation took hold in the 1970s, investors wanted more and more interest from their bonds. They just said, no, I'm not going to buy your bonds unless you raise the interest rate. And then Mr. Paul Volcker, who was appointed by President Jimmy Carter. Yes, I know, dear students, we had a president named Jimmy. They worked to break the back of inflation. Well, it was actually Mr. Volcker who did it. Carter appointed Volcker as the Federal Reserve chairperson. The Federal Reserve chairperson is often called the second most powerful person in the country. The president controls the military, the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Board, the chairman being the most important person, controls the money supply. And they can do wondrous things and horrible things with that money supply. And so they broke the back of inflation, and you see inflation dropping very quickly, and then bonds slowly, slowly, slowly dropping until the Great Recession. And look, we had negative inflation, which is really called deflation, but you hear people say negative inflation. And if you think inflation is bad, and it is, we don't want rampant inflation. We certainly don't want deflation, because it sounds all well and good. Yay, milk has gone down, you know, whatever. Shoes have gone down in price, but the biggest component of inflation is wages. People's wages are going down. Housing was going down. And this is what was so terrible about the Great Recession and was so dangerous about the Great Recession. We had deflation, but luckily just for a short period of time. And then wages have slowly grown. Housing has slowly grown, but now housing is starting to seem to, well, it did about a year or so ago. It started to peak. It started to really jump up, and now it started slowing down. So you see the relationship? Good. Let's continue. Slide number 24, the yield curve. What is the yield curve? Well, this is a graph that represents the relationship between a bond's maturity and its yield at a given point in time. So we use it to make comparisons among types of bonds and their maturities. Normally, the yield curve is upward sloping. Longer-term bonds have higher interest rates than shorter-term bonds and treasury bills and notes, right? It's not a 5-year or 10-year bond. It's a 10-year note or 5-year note. But I use the term bond, so you don't have to get used to it. As we said, it makes sense, right? The longer the money is out there, the more chances for things to go wrong, and the more interest rates we're going to expect. You ask for a 30-year mortgage and you get a certain rate. Ask for a 15-year mortgage, they'll drop the rate usually at least 0.5%, sometimes more. But sometimes, dear students, the yield is downward sloping. It's called an inverted yield curve. Shorter-term bonds and notes and bills have higher interest rates than longer-term bonds. That doesn't make any sense. Hang on a minute. Slide number 25. Here in the red, the bottom, is a typical upward sloping curve. Shorter-term instruments, treasury bills, notes, bonds, pay much less interest than longer term. And that's what we normally see. But there are times in history when the curve inverts. We have a downward sloping inverted curve. We're going to investigate this in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at the current yield curve. We're going to investigate why, but let's take a look at the yield curve now as it is April 8th, 2019. And so the light gray, the very light gray, is what happened last year. And we see exactly what we saw in the previous slide. An upward sloping curve. Short-term interest rates were less than longer-term interest rates going out to 30 years. But then a few months ago, specifically, I forget exactly when it was, the beginning of the year, January, the yield curve started to invert. 2- and 5-year notes were paying less than treasury bills. And just recently, that was 1 month ago, and the medium term, but the darkest one is April 8th. The 2- and 5-year have inverted. They have gone below what 3-month and 6-month treasury bills are paying. Now, the 10-year, the 20, 30 years, they're still paying more than not much more than the short-term interest rates. So the curve has inverted very slightly. But still, if you bother, go online, go read any of the financial publications, you will see tons of ink or electrons spilled over what has happened and what does it mean for the future. Okay, so we'll come back to that in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at slide 27 and 28, where we cover the theories for why normally longer-term debt securities have higher interest rates than shorter-term debt securities. Well, the first one is the expectations. The shape of the yield curve reflects investors' expectations of future interest rates. Well, that makes sense, right? Because it's all about the future. Yeah. So what we're saying is when it inverts, people are expecting shorter-term rates to go down or longer-term rates to go down. Something's going on here, right? The maturity preference hypothesis, which is what we tend to think of, sometimes called liquidity preference. Investors tend to prefer short-term securities. Why? Because they know they're going to get their money in 3, 6, 9 months. Whereas if you're going to hold, let your money be out there for 15, 20, 30 years, you're going to want a premium. You're going to want more interest. And you know, that makes perfect sense. So let's take a look at the third one, the market segmentation hypothesis, which says, you know what? Each of those different time frames, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, they all have their own supply and demand curve. And if you've taken economics, you know what that little supply and demand curve looks like. And so that, since it's a market-based system, supply and demand. Oh, by the way, I don't know if I told you this joke. What do you get when you teach a parrot to say supply and demand? A learned economist. Don't worry, they say jokes about us finance and investment people. Each of these three theories makes sense, and each has some merit. But how do we account for the times when the yield curve is inverted? I mean, it doesn't make sense. What factors could cause an inverted yield curve to occur? And what can the yield curve tell us about the future of the economy? Bum, 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 cue the scary music. Well, dear students, slide 29. Since World War II, every time the yield curve has inverted, when short-term rates were higher than longer-term rates, the economy has fallen into a recession. There was one exception in 1966 where the economy just went to zero. No growth, but then didn't contract, did not experience what they call negative growth, which is sort of, you don't really need to say that, just call it contraction, right? And that's what a recession is defined as. 2 quarters, 6 months, where the economy, instead of growing, is contracting. And that's not fun. You know, we don't want that to happen. Sometimes we don't really have control over it because nothing we've ever done is perfect. And that means people are losing their jobs and exactly. There's a lot of unemployment. We're not producing what we could produce. And it's not something we love to happen. But it happens. And we know it's coming. We just don't know when. The yield curve has recently inverted, ever so slightly, as we saw in a few slides ago, causing renewed feared angst and all kinds of gnashing and weeping of gnashing of teeth and beating of breast and weeping of tears of an imminent recession. The problem is, even though this indicator has a very high correlation to a recession, which is a fancy way of saying every time we've seen this thing happen, we've had a recession except for once. The time frame is totally arbitrary. It might happen quickly, within 6 months. It might not happen for 2, 3 years. So you just don't know. For example, the last recession, 2008-09, for about 2 years before the beginning of 2008, the yield curve was slightly inverted. It looked almost flat, except for the 4, 5, 10 year, 2 year. They were just a tiny bit lower than the short-term interest rates, and then it bounced back up at the 30-year mark. So it was an inversion, but not a very dramatic one, as the one we see now is not very dramatic. And for a little over 2 years, the stock market didn't believe it. They just kept, stocks kept going higher and higher, and people just did not believe a recession was coming. It wasn't until the fall of 2008 that the officials charged with tracking the economy acknowledged we were in a recession. It took over 2 years, but the bond ghouls, as they are often called, were finally proven correct. Now, why are they called bond ghouls? It's not a very nice name, and most bond investors really don't want recessions. But what happens in a recession? Interest rates fall, less demand for money. The Federal Reserve knocks down short-term interest rates. The lower demand for money and mortgages knocks down longer-term interest rates. What happens when interest rates fall? Right. If you don't remember, you go back and do chapter 9. Bond prices rise, right? So that's why they're often called the bond ghouls. And I got to tell you, folks, bond investors are often far more persnickety, far more, pessimistic and very realistic than stock investors who are often very euphoric. So we watch the bond ghouls for when they invert the yield curve because they're often correct. Slide number 30. So what's the takeaway? Are we going to have a recession? Yeah, we're going to have it. When are we going to have it? Nobody knows. If you put a gun to my head and said, we're going to have a recession, I would say, I think it's going to be sooner than later. Many people keep saying, not for 2020, 2021. But you see car sales dropping. That's usually a very strong indicator. You see home prices softening. That's another big indicator. We're still seeing strong unemployment, so that hasn't turned sour yet. But if you go back and look at recessions, unemployment is usually a lagging indicator. Right, unemployment usually lags the recession, and then the other shoe drops, and people start losing their jobs. So you decide, and your guess is pretty much as good as anybody else, so you could get a $500,000 a year job on Wall Street predicting the next recession, because there are people who are paid tremendous sums of money to predict where the economy is going to go, when the recession is going to hit, where our interest rates are going to go. And they never get it right. Maybe they get it right once, but they get paid tremendous sums to incorrectly predict it. So you could be one of them too. What's wrong? Why not you? Slide number 30. Okay, slide number 30. Bond pricing. Now, let's get serious. Bonds are normally priced according to the present value of their future cash flow. That sounds familiar, right? We're going to take a look at the interest payments. Now, remembering that the bond pays us every 6 months, typically. Some bonds pay every month, but not usually quarterly. But most bonds, at least in this class, are going to pay every 6 months, semi-annual interest payments. Plus, we're going to get our $1,000 back. Now, some bonds, $5,000, $10,000. But look, in this class, they will always be $1,000, just to make life easier. Although other factors will always need to be considered, such as the credit worthiness of the issuer. Because if the issuer runs into trouble, what's going to happen to the price of that bond? It's going to fall, as we saw in Chapter 9, as investors start dumping the bonds because they're afraid of default. So we always have to keep that in mind. But the truth is, most bonds pay their interest payments, and then you get your principal back. Just as most people pay their car loans and their credit cards and their mortgages. Now, there's always problems, right? And there's always problems in the bond market. But it's the exception, not the norm. Until there's a recession. So slide number 31. Let's take a look at the formula. Now, you really should get out that formula sheet from Chapter 10 and the present value table that you find there, because we're going to refer to that in just a while. So get that out there. Print it out or have it on the screen. The bond price is equal to the present value of the interest income added to the present value of the principal repayment. Hey, we've seen this before. It's the discounted cash flow model. Remember, we calculated the present value of the dividends that were paid by the stock, and then we used the expected price of the stock to be the future cash flow, and we calculated the present value of that and added the two together. Well, we're going to do the exact same thing for bonds. But because bonds are so much more reliable, the calculations are going to be far more predictive and far more we can put more value in our calculations. We really should be doing semi-annual compounding instead of annual compounding, but we're going to do annual compounding just because it's easier, and you're going to get almost the exact same answer. It's going to be a few dollars off. And that's why we have spreadsheets. So after you've learned how to do it manually, go take a look at the spreadsheet that's in Canvas and on the website, and you will say, this is easy. Right, because the computer is going to do it for you. But you need to learn how to do it first, all right? So make sure you got the present value table, because now let's take a look at a real-life example. This is a bond from a company called Schlumberger. Now, I've heard it Schlumberger, But I think it's actually Schlumberger, because I think the company actually had its roots in France or a French consortium. But it's global. It's a global company, and it's based in Houston. It's the world's largest maker of refining equipment, oil. They're in the oil business, but they don't. Maybe they do refine, but they build the equipment, right? They're the people who build the drills and the refining and all that stuff, right? Check them out because they're a pretty cool company. Now, this bond, when it was issued, was paying 4.3%. That's the coupon yield. That's the nominal yield. It will always stay that way. Bonds are fixed. And it's not due until May 1st, 2028. And this is April 2019, so I chose that time frame just to make life easier because our tables are on the whole year. And I also choose this bond because it's priced to yield 3.974%, which is pretty darn close to 4% because, again, the tables are now on the whole interest rate. so that's the reason. So that's the reason we chose this bond, okay? So let's take a look at the current yield. You can do the calculation on your own, but I looked it up. It's 4.19% because we're paying a little bit more than $1,000. It's rated AA-, so it's, you know, the investment grade bond, and 3.974% is close to 4%, so let's use 4%, and we're close to 9 years, a little bit more than 9 years, so our calculation is going to be a little different, a little bit less than 4%, but still, we're going to get real close to what the bond is actually selling for. So here's the formula. You take the present value of the interest income, and you add that to the present value of the repayment. Now, do you remember the discounted cash flow model? What dividends did we get paid over the first year, second year, third year? And then we added all that up. And then we took the expected stock price and discounted that and added that up. Well, we're going to get $43 for 9 years. So if we were to use the if we were to use the present value table from Chapter 6, and that's exactly what is you're looking at here, you'll notice that the present value sheet, the present value tables in Chapter 10, there are two of them, and we'll say why in just a minute. But here's the present value table from Chapter 6. It's the exact same table. We could type $43 times the present value multiplier for year number one. $43 times the present value multiplier for year number two. $43 times the present value. You see, what you got to do this 9 times. Poo on that. That's why Chapter 10 has this second table, which says, let's take a look at the present value of a stream of payments. Boy, it's not going to make life a whole lot easier. So we go to 4% and down to 9 years. So that's the present value multiplier. So remember what it is? 7.43%. You got it? You got it? Good. So now let's go back to the presentation. And that's exactly what we did. We took $43 times 7.4315%. I'm sorry. What does that mean? In other words, we're going to get $43 a year for 9 years. What is it worth to us today? That's what present value tells us. Well, it's it's like $390, right? Not quite $430, but it's only 9 years. But what's it worth to us today at 4%? Well, we multiply the $43 times 7.435, and it's worth almost $320, $319.705. $43 for the next 9 years per year at 4% is worth to us today, the present value, $319 and approximately 71 cents. Now, we're also going to get $1,000 in 9 years. But that's only a one-time payment. They don't pay $1,000 every year. That's the repayment of the principal. So we go back and we use the table that we used back in Chapter 6. It's the same table. We go across the 4%, go down to 9 years, and there's the present value multiplier for a one-time payment, a lump sum principal, as it's called. So remember that number, 0.703. Make sure I got it right. Make sure I got it right, Piano. Yes, I did. 7.703. So multiply 1,000 times 0.703, and that's $703. That's an easy calculation. I mean, you can do that in your head. You add the $319, the present value of the interest income, plus the $703, the present value of the repayment of the bond's principal, and you get $1,022.71. So we should predict that this bond is worth, or we estimate that this bond is worth $1,022.71. Now, what was the quoted price? Look at that. $1,026.32. Right. Exactly. The bond calculator spreadsheet on the class website gives us $1,024.41 for annual payments. And it also gives us $1,027.02 for semi-annual payments. Wait a minute. It's very close, right? They're all three very close to the actual price of $1,026. Why is the semi-annual payment prediction, right? Why is the semi-annual payments prediction, singular, a bit higher than the annual payments prediction? Well, think about it. We're getting that $43 in two payments. We're actually getting $21.50 after 6 months, and then the next 6 months we're getting the next $21.50. So we're getting the money a little faster than we thought. We originally said we're getting $43 at the end of every year for the next 9 years. But no. We're getting $21.50 after 6 months, and then we're getting the next $21.50. And that's why the semi-annual payment is worth a couple bucks more, $3 more, not even, $2.50 more than the annual payment. So, hey, round off error. But it shows us once again that bonds are boring. Right? And bonds are very predictable. And you know what? That's why people love them. If you want to sleep well at night, you want bonds. And we already showed you, and I'm going to show you again later on, that, hey, with balanced, we can sleep well and eat reasonably well. Sleep reasonably well and eat reasonably well. So we'll come back to that. But is this cool? Now you're going to do the worksheet. There's actually three worksheets. Do the three worksheets. There are answer keys, commentaries. Then make sure you take a look at the spreadsheet, because the spreadsheet's actually very cool. As we learned in Chapter 5, doing the discounted cash flow model and over again, not until you're sick of it, it gets tiresome, right? We want it to be tiresome here. We want you to understand exactly what you're doing. Do it until you can do it in your sleep, until you see it in your dreams. Then use the spreadsheet. Well, the same thing is true here. Use the spreadsheet after you've done the calculation a few times, and you'll find that it's relatively easy. Cool? Yes, bonds indeed are boring. Good. That's why we love them. Well, not me personally, but that's why many investors love them. I think they're too darn boring. But that's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. I tell younger folks, you don't even want to touch bonds until you're in your 40s, 50s. But everyone's different. If you're the kind of person who's worried about sleeping at night, you want to have some bond exposure as ballast, as your airbag when there's a crash. But what are we seasoned investors? I count myself as one because I've been through a few. What do we seasoned investors do when there's a crash? We rush in. Maybe too soon, like I did in 2008. I should have waited a couple of weeks. Slide 33. Now, let's take a look at a few different risks that we haven't looked at yet. We've looked at the inflation risk, right? Interest rates fall, bond prices rise. Interest rates rise, bond prices fall. And we looked at default risk, the risk of the bond just not paying, a company going bankrupt or whatever. Now let's take a look at reinvestment risk, because this one is a little subtle. But again, it shows us once again why a long-term time horizon is essential for we prudent, long-term oriented investors. Reinvestment risk is the uncertainty about the future value of an investor's bond investments that result from the need to reinvest bond interest payments and redemptions at yields not known in advance. What? Let me read that one again. Right? What's going on here? Well, look, if you're a serious bond investor, not just investing with a bond mutual fund, because the bond mutual fund managers take care of this for you. But if you're buying bonds, you're continually getting those coupon payments. You're continually getting your interest payments, right? You're clipping your coupon, as they say. You're also having bonds mature. So now you got cash coming into your account, right? They used to send you checks, not anymore. It goes into your account. you have to turn around and reinvest them. Unless you're living off the interest. If you're living off the interest, then it doesn't apply. But now you have to turn around and reinvest them. So changing interest rates don't only affect the price of your bonds. They also affect your future income, as you need to reinvest the interest income and bond repayments. If interest rates have fallen, your income level will fall as you reinvest your income and bond repayments. Likewise, if interest rates have risen, your income level will rise. So you see people go, ooh, 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 interest rates have fallen, my bonds are worth more. Great. Now you're buying new bonds at a lower interest, so your future income is going to be less. Interest rates have risen, oh my goodness, my bonds have fallen in value, oh, what should I do, what should I sell? No, no, you should buy more. Why? Because interest rates have risen. You see what's going on here? Again, take a long-term perspective in both situations and realize that if the world ends, it doesn't matter where your money is, right? Duration. Now, this one's even more subtle, and it's something that most of us will never have to worry about because most of us are not going to have millions of dollars to invest in bonds, or at least, you know, hundreds of millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is a measure of a bond price's sensitivity to changes in interest rates and bond yields. See, it captures both the price and the reinvestment risk. See, it looks at not only what's happening with the price, but what's happening with new bonds that you're buying. It's used to indicate how a bond will react in different interest rate environments. The duration of a bond changes as it approaches its maturity date and as current interest rates change. And we're not going to do the calculations. It's for bond mutual fund managers or pension fund managers. But the longer a bond's maturity, the longer a bond's maturity, the longer its duration. The higher a bond's nominal rate and yield to maturity, the shorter the duration. So you can look it up. You just look it up, right? And we don't want you to learn how to do it. And so now, what pension fund managers and bond mutual fund managers do is they use duration to immunize. That's a bad choice of words. But investors who have a specified time horizon can use bond immunization to increase the probability of successfully achieving their desired goal. So in other words, if you need this money in 5 years, you can keep your average duration of your bond investments equal to that 5 years, or 10 years, or 2 years. You would thus be more protected against interest rate-induced swings. Now, what's the problem with this? It requires constant rebalancing of your bond portfolio since durations of bonds change as interest rates change and as bonds get closer to maturity, which means you have a huge bond portfolio, which most people just don't have. Who has this? Pension fund managers, insurance companies, bond mutual fund managers. They have to worry about this because if you buy a, for example, intermediate term bond, and you're expecting that bond, you know, for money you need in 3, 4, 5 years, you want those bond mutual fund managers to make sure that they're not loaded up on long bonds so that if interest rates rise all of a sudden, right before you're going to take the money out, boom, the value of your bond fund falls. You see that? So we retail investors are just not going to have to worry about it. But it's important for us to know because this is an introduction to investments class and you are the investment guru for your friends and families and coworkers, and you can't let them down because it is a very serious and important responsibility. Slide 36. Okay, so let's take a look at three different bond investment strategies. The income strategy, which is certainly the simplest. You purchase the bonds for their interest income. You don't care about what's going on with interest rates. You buy the bond, you live off the interest. The capital gain strategy says, ooh, 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 I'm going to speculate that interest rates will fall. What do we say about people being paid tremendous sums of money to incorrectly determine what's going to happen with interest rates? And that's certainly the hardest to implement. And then the total return return strategy is basically a combination of the two. You as a bond investor are looking for bonds for income and you're looking for bonds for capital gains. And that's in between, and I've already answered the question. questions at the bottom. And sometimes you'll see total return bond fund or income fund, or usually a capital gain strategy will have some kind of fancy term, which means danger, speculative. If we could really screw up, if we zig when we should zag. And again, it goes back to why we buy bonds. For the most part, people buy bonds for income. Thank you very much. I get my money back at the end of the term. Cool. All right, now, laddering. You'll often hear people talk about bond laddering. Well, it's just a fancy word for diversification. You purchase bonds with staggering maturities. Some short term, some intermediate term, some long term. Again, this is very popular with pension funds, insurance companies, bond mutual fund managers. Why? Because they have considerable sums of money to invest. So what are the advantages and disadvantages? Well, the advantage is you're diversified. Cool. What's the disadvantage? You're diversified. Diversification is a good thing. But, as we're going to see, not this next short chapter, but when we get to chapter 11 where we tie everything together, diversification also means that something in our portfolio is going to make us angry. It's going to make us sad. Why didn't we put everything over here? Because that's why we diversified. Because next year it's going to be the opposite, right? And so bond laddering ensures that you're diversified. And some will do well in different interest rates environments and, of course, recessions. And others will do better. So here's an example of a current bond ladder. As of again April 8th, and we once again thank Fidelity for the information, and we see that inversion, right? There is the 2.43%, 2.43% in the 3 and 6 month treasury, and then in the 5 year treasury 2.33, 10 year treasury 2.51. So that's a little higher, right? 2 year treasury 2.37, and notice the spread in corporates in the short end is not very high. But once you get out to the longer end, it's getting higher, because I saw some 30-year corporate bonds paying well over 5.5%, which is finally getting back to where bonds really should be. You know, bonds really should be like 4, 5, 6%, maybe even 7 if they're more risky. But in the short end, the spread is still pretty tight, in my humble opinion. But 5-year, no, not as tight here. 2.33, 5.28, almost 100 basis points, almost 1%. So we would, if we were interested in long-term long-term income from our bonds, we had tons of money to invest, we would buy a bond ladder, and then we would be protected against things that just came out of the blue and blew us up if we had gone all long or all short or whatever. Cool? Cool. So there you go. You can have that one. That's all yours. And we are done. Slide 39. We are done with bonds. You're not too sleepy. I know bonds are not exciting, but they are reliable. Now, we're going to take a short jaunt and discuss hybrid securities. We made mention of them way back in Chapter 1, where we took a look at preferred stocks and convertible securities. Well, we didn't look at them in detail. We just said they exist, and they're really not for the vast majority of us, so we'll burn through this very quickly. Don't worry about it. But, in fact, I think I give you the answers for the exam for those preferred stock and convertible securities. I think I give you the questions and the answers. I think I do. Yeah, I do. Now, because, dear students, after we finish that, we're ready to tie up the entire semester together. We're ready to go back to the very beginning from when we started and look back now at our journey in Chapter 11, where we discuss asset allocation. Keep up the great work, students. We are so, so proud of you. You are awesome. You've come this far. Don't give up. We're on the downhill side of the semester. See you in our next chapter.